I am intrigued by history, which I'm sure is not exactly shocking to all of you. And you're thinking, oh, brother, here we go again. Probably it's because I've lived through so much of it by now. But increasingly, that seems to be the case. Along those lines, my wife Janelle and I had a unique experience last Sunday evening. She had spotted an announcement about a free event to be held in Cleveland at the Maltz Performing Arts Center on the Case Western Reserve University campus, which is not far from Severance Hall and University Circle, as it's called. And Severance is, of course, the home of the Cleveland Orchestra, with which we are quite familiar. I'm not sure what it was that caught her attention, whether it was performing arts, University Circle, or free. But either way, or any of those ways, it did work out well. The venue itself, the building was built shortly after World War I, and it was dedicated in 1923, originally designed and built as a Jewish temple. It is now a performing arts center. The event was titled as The Children of Willesden Lane. We couldn't really determine if it was a concert or a lecture or exactly what. We only knew that it had something to do with what was called the Kinder Transport, which was a series of trains that were taking Austrian Jewish children who were in danger after the Anschluss in 1938. Anschluss is the German word for union, and that basically annexed the nation of Austria to Nazi Germany in 1938, putting in immediate danger the Jewish families in Austria. It turns out that it was both and more. The presenter was, or is, a Grammy-winning concert pianist by the name of Mona Golubek. She was also a storyteller of the First Order, blending her presentation with both snippets of music, because she is a concert pianist, along with her sister, Renee, her younger sister, and with her own personal history, but especially that of her mother. The core of the presentation was her story about her mother, Lisa Jura, J-U-R-A, who was a 14-year-old Austrian Jewess living with her family in Vienna in 1938. Her parents, Abraham and Malka Jura, were, a prosperous middle-class family. Her father was a tailor of the First Order. Her mother was also a very gifted pianist. We were very moved by the story. It was one of hardship and terrible disruption, but amazing success. How she survived and was cared for in a home in London with 31 other young refugees in a house at 243 Willesden Lane made for a fascinating evening. She had two sisters. She was the middle of two sisters, Rosie and Sonia, her two sisters. One was 3 years older, I believe, and one 2 years younger. And her father, Abraham, was out. His business had been shuttered and closed because he was a Jew. And so his family didn't understand why he had taken to playing card games for money. But he came home after being beaten up severely the night of Kristallnacht, the night when the storefronts and homes of Jewish businesses and families were destroyed and shattered with rocks, and it was known as the Night of the Broken Glass, Kristallnacht. He was beaten, but he managed to come home, and he showed his family what he had in his hand. It was one ticket for a transport on the Kinder Transport to take one child to safety in England. Lisa was chosen to be the child. There have been so many other fascinating things to learn, but naturally, hearing as much as we did, we had to buy the book already, so we're ready to get into that. I won't spill all the beans, but to make at least a partial happy story, amazingly, all three daughters survived. Her younger daughter, or younger sister, I should say, got a ticket on the last Kinder transport and also made it to safety in England. Her older sister and her parents were taken to Auschwitz, where her parents both died, but her older sister survived. So it's quite the story. And now what Mona does is travels around the world telling her mother's story. That all goes back, of course, to before my time, 1938 Austria. And so I need to read the book and learn even more than we were able to in that short presentation that evening. As I say, she was a very engaging storyteller, mixed in with some very capable piano playing. And not as quite as good as my wife, but close. So. Another story that will always stand out for me was from another book titled The Day the World Came to Town. Subtitle is 911 in Gander, Newfoundland. We saw this one in one of the bookstores on one of our Canadian trips in St. John's, Newfoundland several years ago, two or three years back, and we had to buy it. Gander's about a three-hour drive from St. John's, which is where we visit when we go to Newfoundland. It has a large runway. It's a military airport. It's capable of landing commercial airliners. It's been a U.S. airbase for some years. It's a holdover from earlier times, both military and commercial, when commercial aircraft had shorter ranges and many planes had to land there to refuel before continuing from North America to Europe or vice versa. Now, of course, the ranges of commercial airliners are much greater. Most of you, of course, will recall 911 very clearly, a day etched in memory. But you know what? Because we just had the commemoration of the 20th anniversary of 911, unless you are at least in your mid to late 20s, you have no recollection of it. Isn't that astonishing to those of us for whom it's clearly etched in our memory? You could probably say exactly where you were when you first saw the images of the Twin Towers being flown into by airplanes, jet planes. But it's over 20 years ago. On that day when terrorist attacks commandeered four planes with evil intent to use them as weapons against this country, for the first time in aviation history, all U.S. airspace was closed to non-military traffic. All commercial and private aircraft in the skies were commanded to land as soon as possible at whatever airfield was close and could handle the traffic. Amazingly, there were no crashes of airplanes scrambling to get out of the air over North America, United States, that day. The military was given orders to shoot down unresponsive and unidentified aircraft, even if the aircraft were a commercial airliner or a private plane that did not respond to instructions. Because, of course, in the early stages, it wasn't known how many had been commandeered by terrorists. Obviously, in those early hours, details were very sketchy and just unknowable. Several flights were on their way to this country from Europe and were in the air at the time the attacks became known. Those inbound flights nearing North America were instructed to land in Canadian airports or, if they could, turn around and go back to Europe. If they had reached what is sometimes called the point of no return, they had to continue toward this continent. 38 commercial flights with 6,595 passengers and crew landed in Gander, Newfoundland, whose population at that time was about 10,000 people. 70% of the town population was on the runways waiting to be processed. Again, they had delays in processing because it wasn't known if one of those planes was harboring terrorists. So it took a while to get everyone processed and off. The story of how that small city and surrounding towns housed and fed and cared for those people over the next week until U.S. airspace reopened is very heartwarming. There were friendships formed. People have stayed in touch. There was even a touring off-Broadway musical production that was made called Come From Away, Come From Away, which is the Newfoundland phrase, if you're not from there. When my wife and I were there not quite 2 years ago to conduct the funeral for Mrs. Blanche Smith, a sweet lady from the neighborhood came up to my wife and she said, "Have you come from away, dear?" And so my wife knew exactly how to respond. She said, "Yes, we have." Of course, for my wife and me, underlying any and all talk of historical and perhaps prophetic events, we keep hearkening back to our trip to Israel about 2.5 years ago now. That will always be very, very special in our minds. But there's something else in common with these stories and others, and that is this. They both involve an alignment of religious and political forces in our world that are in so many ways foreign to us. They involve an alignment of religious and political forces that don't immediately add up in our minds. They don't seem to mesh. But could those strange alignments gather steam, move into unexpected patterns in the world we think we know? I guess what I'm asking, brethren, is what prophetic events may take shape as we continue to watch what our world is going through? There is one key source to check, of course, and it has some interesting things to tell us. And of course, since this is church and this is a sermon, I'm talking about the Bible. That was probably not exactly a hidden clue to you. Where is our world right now? You can say, well, we have about a month and a half left in the year 2021, give or take. That's true. But I'm not talking about 73 years ago in 1938, Vienna, Austria, or 20 years ago in 2001, northeastern United States, with airliners taking off from Boston, New York, with evil intent. But I'm talking about now. What lies in the future? More space flights? Now it's even a commercial venture. You can actually, if you have enough money, and I'm sure many of you just have that kind of chump change lying around, multiple thousands of dollars to pay for a flight into suborbital space. In fact, William Shatner, famous actor, age now 90, was beamed up recently himself. Now we know him from Medicare and Medicaid ads. Tragically, one of his fellow passengers on the flight that he recently completed died just 2 days ago in a small light plane crash in New Jersey. Glenn DeVries, a New Jersey businessman, 49 years old. He flew into suborbital space and died in a light plane crash. That's the unpredictable nature of our world. But back to our main topic. What about the dark side of human nature that's revealed in stories like Mona Golubek's story about her mother Lisa Yura? What about the day the world came to town in Gander, Newfoundland? What made that necessary? For all those heartwarming stories, why were those things even in place? Why did there have to be a Kinder transport to try to take threatened Austrian children to safety? Why did Gander find it necessary to roll out the red carpet of hospitality to take care of nearly 6,600 guests who descended from the skies on their little town? 38 commercial airliners sitting on the airstrip. Well, problems is because of the evil in human hearts, brethren, that murdered 10 million people in the Holocaust, 6 million of them Jews. Or 3,000 people who died on 9/11. Which will triumph? Kindness and courage? Or evil? Or is there more to it than that? Historically, we tend to look at national and military and maybe commercial trends. That's what history seems to be built around. We look at nations operating based on their own interests. But what lies ahead for our world? I couldn't help but think in those terms this past Sunday, listening to the story of young Lisa Jura in Austria and England, and eventually in the United States, where she immigrated in 1949 with her husband. She married a decorated French resistance fighter from World War II. And her two daughters, Mona and Renee, were born in this country. In that list that I gave you, maybe we should include religious, not just national, military, and commercial trends. Maybe we should include religious, but we're not used to looking at that in our Western view of current events and history. We're not used to considering religion as an influential director of events. But in fact, that's what 9-1-1 was all about at its core, wasn't it? And wasn't there an element of religion in the Holocaust as well, or at least a hatred toward an ethnic group, distinguished perhaps by some of its practices? Not that every Jew is a practicing Jew. Most Jewish people are probably no more religious than the average American. At least in our culture here, they're not. My wife and I visited Yad Vashem when we were in Israel. It is an inexpressibly moving visit and horrifically sad. When I use the term the West, that leads us to think and talk in those terms, East versus West, especially in religions. We all know what we mean by it. If I say Eastern religion, you have some idea what I'm talking about. If I say Western religion, you have some idea what I'm talking about. For example, let me list some major religious branches, and you write down, if you're taking notes, whether you think of them as Eastern or Western. If I say Catholicism, what do you think? Eastern or Western? If I say Hinduism, what do you think? Eastern or Western? Buddhism, Eastern or Western? Protestantism, Eastern or Western? Islam, Eastern or Western? You see what I mean? By and large, we think of the world of Christianity, what we call Christianity, as Western, and non-Christian religions, for the most part, we consider Eastern. The reality is it's not quite that simple, especially when you're talking about Islam. It's not quite that simple. Some realigning of our world may yet be ahead of us, and religion will at some point be a factor. Turn to Daniel chapter 11. Daniel chapter 11 and verse 40. Now this comes at the end of the longest single and most detailed prophecy in the Bible, which you've probably heard many times. It covers several years, hundreds of years sometimes, of very specific history and prophecy. History now, it was prophecy when it was written. But in verse 40 it says, "At the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him." Now, who is him? Well, it's a civil or nationalistic power, but it's connected to religion because it says in verse 37, "He will not regard the God of his fathers, nor the desire of men, nor regard any God. He'll exalt himself above them all. In their place he shall honor a God of fortresses, and a God which his fathers did not know he'll honor with gold and silver, precious stones and pleasant things." But then this him, "At the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots, horsemen, many ships. And he'll enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. he shall also enter the glorious land. And many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. He shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt. The Libyans and the Ethiopians shall follow at his heels. But news from the east and the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate many. And he shall plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. Yet he shall come to his end, and no one will help him. Do you remember these verses? I'm sure you've read them before. Interesting, isn't it, that what we see happening religiously before our eyes in roughly the last 20 years or so, let's say since 9/11, is a realigning of the religious world into a north-south contrast rather than the east-west one we're so familiar with politically. If you start looking at the growth, for example, even of Christianity, you'll find that there are some areas where it is growing very rapidly, but for the most part, primarily not in what the areas that we consider to be the root and the home and the core of Christianity, Europe and North America. That's not where it's growing the fastest. Is it out of the question that religion could once again begin to dominate headlines? It doesn't really dominate our headlines now. And I don't mean the declining influence of religion in the life of the average Westerner, because that's where we are in our culture. It has a declining influence. I've seen some polls that indicate the reputation and the influence of clergymen has sunk almost to the level of lawyers. Sorry about that, Mr. Henderson. Terrible poll. Well, we're all in the same boat, my friend. But if we're talking about the radical elements of Islam, it already has changed. And it already is beginning to creep into a dominant position. And really has, certainly since 9/11. It really didn't start with that, and it certainly didn't end with it. The source of the ultimate conflict leading up to the return of Jesus Christ, and our Israel trip certainly brought all that powerfully to mind, will probably have many factors. We've seen pressure on European nations, for example, for several years, and certainly in those last 20 years, from the oil-producing states of the Middle East as one factor. Isn't that a southern element pushing at a northern element? Well, I think it is. Dictating political policy. You will do this, or we will shut off the oil. We see tensions escalating with various nations in the Middle East and the United States, let alone Israel. Where else, what else will be shaping events at the end time? Turn to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. I've been harping on 2 Thessalonians recently in some messages. Kind of a reason. There's a lot there. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 1. Now, brethren, concerning the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, that's the parousia in Greek, the appearing, the reappearing of Christ, and our gathering together to him, we ask you not to be soon shaken in mind or troubled either by spirit or by word or by letter, as if from us, as though the day of Christ had come. Let no one deceive you by any means. For that day will not come unless the falling away comes first, and the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. Now, some of those words seem to echo Daniel 11 in places, don't they? Do you not remember that when I was with you still, I told you these things? Interesting words from Paul. There are several factors here. For one, the body of believers itself, God's church, those who are his, those in whom his spirit dwells, must first experience what he calls a falling away. It doesn't say the great falling away. Sometimes we've said that, but it doesn't actually appear there. It just says the falling away. 30 years ago in the church of God, we might have had trouble understanding that. I don't think we do anymore. But there's more. There's something on the world scene itself. There's a man of sin referred to here who, as ludicrous as it sounds to us, will actually claim to be God or his agent or acting for him or something. But it seems to say that he sits as God in the temple of God. So you could say that means, just as God sits in his throne room, this man sits in this temple acting in the same manner. But whatever way, he's going to make some pretty grandiose claims. Now, what would you or I say now in our culture if somebody told you, I'm Jesus? You'd say, somebody call the little guys in the little white coats. Because we would assume that this is someone struggling with some sort of mental illness. And we would hope to get them help and hope that they didn't harm themselves or someone else. Because we would assume there was something wrong with them, right? But there's coming a time somehow when someone who makes what would seem to us now ludicrous claims will be believed. That's hard to understand in our world the way it operates now. But you know, if you had told Abraham and Malka Ura in Vienna, let's say in 1930, when the oldest of their children was about 9, and the next daughter was, somewhere around 6, and the youngest about 4, if you had told them in 1930 what would happen in the next 10 years, could they have believed you? Possibly not. This country has had an isolationist tilt to its history ever since, in a reasonable presentation back then, President Washington enjoined in his farewell address not to get mixed up in the politics of Europe because they were buffered by a big pond. The Atlantic. The Monroe Doctrine was formed to not allow any other nations to interfere on this continent or in this hemisphere. That changed after World War II when President Truman realized we had to engage with the rest of the world. We could not. We were no longer separated. Our world had shrunk. That's just history. But to go to this extreme, somebody saying he's God or acting for God and being believed, it's hard to fathom. But we're looking at it from Western and secular eyes because our culture is secular. Now, we should be at first blush, first, last, always godly people, Christians. That's our first allegiance to his kingdom, his family. That's where we are. That's how we can be bonded with brothers and sisters around the world spiritually who come from other nations, because that's not our first allegiance. But our world is secular, our culture. And it sounds so strange. And for that matter, if we even backed up more than 20 years ago, before 9/11, if we thought then that religious extremism couldn't take hold in our world, most people would have said that. Now we know better. Look at verse 9 in 2 Thessalonians 2. Where will the power come from in this deception? The coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan, with all power, signs, and lying wonders. power and signs and lying wonders. These aren't just going to be parlor tricks. You know, pulling a coin from your hair or behind your ear. Rabbit from a hat. And we're not talking about that. Is he, Satan, clever? Is he powerful? Is he deceptive? You bet he is. Could he deceive you or me? Don't forget verse 3. Paul wrote, "Let no one deceive you by any means." If he wrote that to brethren in the first century, who are we to think ourselves better than they? It doesn't say the falling away will all be accomplished in one moment. We might think, yeah, that happened in the mid-90s. Well, it's not quite that simple, is it? It happened before then, and it has happened since. You can read statistics. I've seen statistics that showed even by the early 1990s, before the middle 90s happened, something like 3 out of every 8 people who had made contact with the Radio Church of God before 1968, or as it became changed in 1968 to the Worldwide Church of God, about 3 out of every 8 who were associated with the church at one point by the early 90s had left. And I'm not talking by death. I'm talking those who were still alive, who'd ever been part of the church, only 5 out of 8 remained. So it was always, there were some coming in the front door and leaving through the back door. It was just the way it was, always. That's an interesting perspective. Turn to Revelation 13. Revelation 13, verse 11. "Then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had 2 horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon." So he looks like one thing, but his words reveal him to be something else. "And he exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence and causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed." That beast is a reference, we believe, to the successive revivals of the ancient Holy Roman Empire. And we believe it refers to a religious influence on that beast power. "He performs great signs so that he even makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. And he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who was wounded by the sword," military, "and lived." Interesting. A beast who looks like a lamb. Who is the most important lamb in the Bible terminology that you know? Lamb of God. Who is the dragon, biblically? We know that too, Satan. "This beast causes the world to worship another beast." The first 9 verses show us that. Does this sound like pretty close to the description Paul gave in 2 Thessalonians? I think it does. They have descriptions in the Bible. Chapter 16, verses 13 and 14, it says, "I saw 3 unclean spirits like frogs coming out of the mouth of the dragon, out of the mouth of the beast, out of the mouth of the false prophet." That's metaphorical, but what comes out of your mouth are usually words. Who inspires those words? "For they are spirits of demons performing signs which go out to the kings of the earth and of the whole world to gather them to the battle of that great day of God Almighty." You know, it's ironic that in Satan's efforts to destroy human beings, he often plays right into God's hands. Astonishing. This sounds very familiar. The beast, the false prophet, they convince people to fight against the returning Christ. I don't know how that will be done exactly, but surely they'll portray him as some attacking alien from space, I guess. There are enough ridiculous board games around that already feed those fantasies and addictions and mental health problems. In Israel, 2.5 years ago, my wife and I stood on Mount Carmel, looking out over the Jezreel Valley. And we could see where vast armies could gather, preparing to move on Jerusalem. We also were near Tel Megiddo, or Har Megiddo, or Armageddon. It's all the same. Back to John's vision in Revelation, this is going to appear to be something of a new religious movement. Nothing like this exists today in our world now, and yet it will be very old. It will shock people. Look at Revelation 17 and verse 7. They will marvel at what it has accomplished, perhaps including how fast it just came out of nowhere. Revelation 17:7, but the angel said to me, "Why did you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the seven heads and the ten horns. The beast that you saw was and is not, and will ascend out of the bottomless pit and go to perdition." It seems to have come out of nowhere. It used to exist in the past. It was destroyed or disappeared. It somehow comes out of this disappearance, out of this abyss, but it's headed to destruction. And those who dwell on the earth will marvel, those whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they see the beast that was and is not and yet is. It sounds puzzling and mystical, but if you begin to understand some of where we believe history has headed and gone back and forth and in and out and active and dormant and active and dormant and so on. But those who give lip service to the beast can't see it. It's a strange thing. What will the world scene seem to be like to those who don't resist this powerful influence? Chapter 18. They will think this is a great thing. Revelation 18, verse 9, the kings of the earth who committed fornication and lived luxuriously with her will weep and lament for when they see the smoke of her burning. When this system is destroyed by Jesus Christ, they'll not know what to do. Standing at a distance for fear of her torment, they don't want to be caught up in it, saying, "Alas, alas, that great city Babylon, that mighty city," the initial name of the first city of revolt against God, "for in 1 hour your judgment has come. And the merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her, for no one buys their merchandise anymore." Is our world driven by economics? I saw an article recently that talked about inflation is back. Aren't you happy? We haven't seen it for 30 years, essentially. And now, in the last year, inflation in this country, as an average, is 6% over last year. So if you're getting Social Security, hoo-hoo, you're going to get a raise next year. But will it catch up with your costs? Bacon costs 20% more than it did a year ago. Are you worried? Used cars cost 26% more, and we have discovered that ourselves. Gas is up 50%. Milk 15 to 20%. Inflation's back. Merchandising drives our world. Merchandise of golds and silver, precious stones and pearls, fine linen and purple, silk and scarlet, every kind of citron wood, every kind of object of ivory, every kind of object of most precious wood, bronze, iron, marble, cinnamon, incense, fragrant oil, frankincense, wine, oil, fine flour, wheat, cattle, sheep, horses, chariots, bodies, and souls of men. What does that mean? Don't know. Some sort of enforced something. Servitude. I don't know. Captivity. The fruit that you're so longed for has gone from you, and all the things which are rich and splendid have gone from you, and you'll find them no more at all. The merchants of these things who became rich by her will stand at a distance for fear of her torment, again, weeping and wailing, saying, "Alas, alas, that great city clothed in fine linen, purple, scarlet, adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls. For in 1 hour those great riches have come to nothing. Every shipmaster, all who travel by ships, sailors, as many as trade on the sea, stood at a distance and cried out when they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, "What is like this great city?" They threw dust on their heads and cried, weeping and wailing, saying, "Alas, alas, that great city in which all who had ships on the sea became rich by her wealth. In 1 hour she's made desolate. Rejoice over her, O heaven, and all you holy apostles and prophets, for God has avenged you on her." There's coming a time when God's plan will not be denied. Of course, any who resist will be cut out of the wealth. That goes back to chapter 13, what we call the mark of the beast. Obviously, there is no such thing in existence now because the beast power is not visible now. But someday it's coming. Does it sound confusing? Turn to Matthew 24. Matthew 24 and verse 4. After the disciples ask him the famous question about when will these things be, what will be the sign of your coming, the end of the age, Jesus answered and said to them, "Take heed that no one deceives you. For many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ,' and will deceive many." These aren't the ones who say they are Christ. These are people who say he's the Christ. But they'll deceive people. That describes, to be blunt, most of what passes for Christianity today. Because they don't do what he said. He said earlier in this chat, in this book, Matthew, you know, Matthew 7, "Why do you say, 'Lord, Lord,' and do not the things that I say?" Drop down to verse 24 of Matthew 24. "For false Christs and false prophets will rise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. See, I have told you beforehand." He says, "I am warning you ahead of time." Sounds like a time of very confusing cross currents religiously. It's interesting, isn't it, that many times in man's history he has thought he could dispense with what God said. And we don't need God. Lately, in the last 150, 200 years or so, he has thought he could dispense with God altogether and religion. Ever heard of the German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche? Died in the year 1900, so probably off your radar. But he's the one who originated the famous movement, "God is Dead." I saw a t-shirt many years ago. I thought it was pretty clever. And the t-shirt was, it was as if a quote and then a source. The quote was, "Nietzsche is dead." And the source, "God." Yep. But there's something in the human mind that just keeps coming back into this search. In Ecclesiastes 3, in verse 11, we read some interesting words. This is the chapter that has the business of a time for every purpose under heaven. You know, beginning in verse 2, a time to be born, a time to die, and so on. In verse 11... of course, Solomon, you know where he was in his head. He was pretty messed up because he was trying to find ultimate fulfillment and happiness physically, and you know the result of his experiment. But in verse 9, it says, "What profit has the worker from that in which he labors? I've seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from beginning to end." That phrase, "he has put eternity in their hearts," has always intrigued me. We are the only creatures on this planet that can have some sort of a sense of what happens after us. Or learn about what happened before us. I was talking with one of the members here before services, and this member was telling me he talked to someone, met someone who was 106 years old. And I had a similar experience as a boy when I was 15 talking to a man who was 105. That's living history that you're talking to there. Astonishing what the overlap can be. Astonishing. And somehow God has put that in our minds. We want to know what came before and we want to know what will come after. Human beings go to all kinds of lengths to create what they consider to be a legacy that will outlive them. They won't be aware of it. Of course, sometimes they think they will. The typical or traditional Christian concept of going to heaven. When I was a little boy before we came into God's church, I always thought that was really creepy. My mom's mom died when I was not quite six, and the idea that grandma was watching me from heaven it creeped me out. It just did. And I was relieved to find out 2 years later when my family came to the church, she was just asleep waiting for the resurrection when I'll get to meet her and talk to her and meet her when she was in full possession of her faculties because she suffered from dementia before she died. God's Word has the answers. But ultimately, there's a great deceptive being standing ready to take advantage of this built-in proclivity in the way that God made us. The future, the Bible shows, holds yet another time of terrible upheaval, religious-based, as Satan will try once again to destroy the potential children of God. My wife and I couldn't help but be struck as we listened to that presentation last Sunday night about an era before our own, a time of the 30s and 40s, an age that we can't really understand, of the age of fascism. Just really can't grasp it. We hear stories, as we did the other night, and appreciate the bravery and the courage of some and have sympathy for the desperation of others who just wanted to survive. It's really tragic what human nature can be brought to. But this all brings it down to us personally. And where do we stand on all of this? What will the future mean to and for us? We know that Satan particularly hates those who resist him. There's a reference in Revelation 12 to what happens after he tries to destroy a portion of God's people. And then he turns his anger and rage against those that he can find who are not being protected by God. It's in Revelation 12 and verse 17. After the story is related of how Satan tries to destroy a portion of the church. But it says, the earth helped the woman, verse 16. The earth opened its mouth and swallowed up the flood, which the dragon spewed out of his mouth. We could speculate about that. But whatever the facts of it will be, here's the reality of the result. And the dragon was enraged with the woman. And he went to make war with the rest of her offspring, who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. So this is God's church, the true church of God, because they keep the commandments and they have the testimony or the witness of Jesus Christ, of who and what he was and who and what he is and the fact that he's coming back as the King of Kings. They know those things. How will we be sure to choose the right path? When a charismatic leader, religious leader of the future, who even has the power to perform miracles, which our media-driven world will surely flash around the globe, you know, it'll be on the internet before you can count, steps on the world scene and appears to be trying to unite all peoples, it will seem to be a good thing. You know, in the early days when Adolf Hitler came to power in Germany, people were saying things, well, at least he makes the trains run on time. And overlooked the fact that some of their friends and neighbors were just disappearing. What will we do? The mass culture will be swayed. That's the picture the Bible paints. It won't seem all that bad at first. What about us? Go back to Paul's letter to the Thessalonians, 2 Thessalonians. Now, we don't know the date of Christ's return, and so we don't know how far ahead it is, and so we don't know which of us will have already been granted a place of safety known as awaiting the resurrection. That is a place of safety. And we don't know which ones will be alive to face that time. We just don't know that yet. Some, there will be a generation in whose lives this happens. If it's ours, we'll find out. If it's those to come, they'll find out too. But Paul's letter to the Thessalonians really holds the answer for all God's people of any time. We read 2 Thessalonians 2:9. Let's pick it up there. The coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan with all power, signs, and lying wonders, and with all unrighteous deception among those who perish because they did not receive the love of the truth that they might be saved. And for this reason, God will send them strong delusion that they should believe the lie. If he's not ready to work in their lives yet and call them, in a way they're protected by not being able to understand it yet, aren't they? Until the time comes, they understand. That they all may be condemned, or sometimes the word can mean judged, who did not believe the truth but had pleasure in unrighteousness. The most important key we can know and know now is here in these verses. Do you see it? Let me ask it this way. Is it important to know the truth? It is crucial. Hold your place here, but go to Romans chapter 10. Please do not faint because I told you to hold your place first before moving to another scripture and then saying, oh, by the way, I have been known to do that on rare occasions. Romans chapter 10, verse 14. It says in verse 13, whoever calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved. But there's a little explanation to that. Some people quote that out of context. How then shall they call on him in whom they have not believed? And how shall they believe in him of whom they've not heard? And how shall they hear without a preacher? And how shall they preach unless they're sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who preach the gospel of peace, who bring glad tidings of good things. You can find references to that in Isaiah and the book of Nahum or Nahum. It is important, and it has to be inspired by God. That's where it comes from. So we must know the truth. Jesus himself said, you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free. Delivered by God's messengers, of course, including his written word and those who are entrusted with delivering it. Is there more? Well, back up a few chapters to Romans 6. Don't lose your place in 2 Thessalonians 2. Romans 6, verse 16. Do you not know that to whom you present yourselves slaves to obey, you are that one slaves whom you obey, whether of sin leading to death or of obedience leading to righteousness. But God be thanked that though you were slaves of sin, yet you obeyed from the heart that form of doctrine to which you were delivered. And having been set free from sin, you became slaves of righteousness. I speak in human terms because of the weakness of your flesh. For just as you presented your members as slaves of uncleanness and of lawlessness leading to more lawlessness, so now present your members as slaves of righteousness for holiness. For when you were slaves of sin, you were free in regard to righteousness. What fruit did you have then in the things of which you're now ashamed? For the end of those things is death. So, clearly it's important to obey God as well. It's not enough just to have the truth. It's important to be obedient. And this passage talks about obedience and about producing fruit in the way of God. Israel knew the elements of truth available in their time. Obedience was another thing. But is there more? Yes, there is. Go back to 2 Thessalonians 2. 2 Thessalonians 2 and verse 10. We just read it. With all unrighteous deception that comes with these signs and lying wonders from the instrument of Satan, among those who perish or are perishing, because they did not receive the love of the truth that they might be saved. And for this reason, God will send them delusion so that they should believe the lie. That's why I say, I wonder if that even has a reference to when the time comes, they'll understand. Knowledge is necessary. It is not enough. Obedience is necessary. It too, by itself, is not enough. If we only obey because we're afraid of the consequences, is that really, are you really following with your heart and mind? I don't think so. I don't think so. God is building his family. That family must learn to think like he does. That means not only knowing, not only obeying, it goes without saying that if our lives are patterns of ignorance or disobedience, we won't be there. But it even goes beyond that. But loving what we know, embracing what we know, internalizing what we know. It depends on what we are doing in that obedience. It means we will adopt as our own the very character of God. Let this mind be in you. How many times have we read that verse? Philippians 2:5. And then it goes on to describe what that mind was like. Revelation 19 has an interesting description that I've always been fascinated by. Revelation 19 in verses 7 and 8. After the obvious physical audible sounds of Christ's imminent return, it says, let us be glad, Revelation 19:7, and rejoice and give him glory, for the marriage of the Lamb has come, and his wife has made herself ready. And to her it was granted to be arrayed in fine linen, clean and bright. For the fine linen is the righteous acts of the saints. Blessed are those who are called to the marriage supper of the Lamb. What a picture. The fine linen is the righteous acts. They wear it. It's who they are. It describes them. It outlines them. It adorns them. It is part of what they are. You ever heard the phrase, clothes makes the man or clothes makes the woman? Well, that's headed the right direction of what we're talking about here. It's not all there is, but it says a lot. Let's look at a familiar section of Scripture and hear the powerful words of a man who came by hard experience to learn how valuable they were. Turn to the 119th Psalm. No, we won't read the whole Psalm. Only half of it. We sing these words. Psalm 119, verse 97. Oh, how I love your law. It's my meditation all the day. You, through your commandments, make me wiser than my enemies, for they're ever with me. I have more understanding than my teachers, for your testimonies are my meditation. I understand more than the ancients or the aged, because I keep your precepts. I've restrained my feet from every evil way so that I may keep your word. I have not departed from your judgments, for you have taught me yourself. How sweet are your words to my taste, sweeter than honey to my mouth. Through your precepts I get understanding, therefore I hate every false way. David had his ups and downs in life, as we know. But when he repented, he did it from the heart. back up to verse 89 and keep going a little bit. My forever, O Lord, your word is settled in heaven. Your faithfulness endures to all generations. You establish the earth, it abides. They continue this day according to your ordinances, for all are your servants. Unless your law had been my delight, I would have perished in my affliction. I will never forget your precepts, for by them you've given me life. I am yours. Save me, for I have sought your precepts. The wicked wait for me to destroy me, but I will consider or give attention to your testimonies. I've seen the consummation of all perfection. Your commandment is exceedingly broad than the words we read. And he goes on, verse 105, your word is a lamp to my feet, a light to my path. I've sworn and confirmed I will keep your righteous judgments. I'm afflicted, revive me. Accept the freewill offerings of my mouth. I'm skimming through. Teach me your judgments. My life is continually in my hand, but I don't forget your law. Your testimonies I've taken as a heritage forever. They are the rejoicing of my heart. And goes on, he says, I hate the double-minded, but I love your law. You're my hiding place and my shield. I hope in your word. Uphold me, verse 116, according to your word that I may live. Don't let me be ashamed of my hope. Hold me up. I'll be safe. Drops down. I have done justice and righteousness. Don't leave me to my oppressors. Don't let the proud oppress me. My eyes fail from seeking your salvation and your word. Deal with your servant according to your mercy. Teach me your statutes. I'm your servant. Give me understanding so I may know your testimonies. Here's one that I pray sometimes. Maybe you do too. It's time for you to act, O Lord, for they have regarded your law as void. Therefore, I love your commandments more than gold, yes, than fine gold. All your precepts concerning all things I consider to be right. Your testimonies are wonderful. My soul keeps them. The entrance of your words gives light, understanding to the simple. I opened my mouth and panted, for I longed for your commandments. Look upon me, be merciful to me, as your custom is toward those who love your name. Direct my steps by your word, and let no iniquity have dominion over me. Sin is an addictive power, brethren, and David says, don't let it have dominion over me. Redeem me from the oppression of man that I may keep your precepts. Make your face shine on your servant. Teach me your statutes. Rivers of water run down from my eyes because men do not keep your law. He got downright emotional about it. What do you think David's opinion of God's law was? Not exactly hard to figure out, is it? Not exactly hard to figure out. Mull over those words. They are life. Are we developing that mind, the mind of Philippians 2:5? And then we can go back to Paul's letter to the Thessalonians again. Second Thessalonians 2, verse 13. We are bound to give thanks to God always for you, brethren beloved by the Lord, because God from the beginning chose you for salvation through sanctification by the Spirit and belief in the truth, to which he called you by our gospel for the obtaining of the glory of our Lord Jesus Christ. Therefore, brethren, stand fast and hold the traditions which you were taught, whether by word or our epistle. Now may our Lord Jesus Christ himself and our God and Father, who has loved us and given us everlasting consolation and good hope by grace, comfort your hearts and establish you in every good word and work. Quite a letter. Astonishing events happened 73 years ago that my wife and I heard from the daughter of one who lived through them. And again, more than 20 years ago on 9/11, astonishing events happened. But what about now? Which way will events go as we contemplate the approaching end of yet another calendar year? How is it the numbers keep getting bigger and faster? Somebody once said, the faster I go, the behinder I get. What will 2022 have in store for us? Or 2023? Or 2024? We don't know. We don't know. It's not possible to predict particular events, even world-changing ones like world wars or terrorist attacks. It's only possible to see where events in the human fabric of history fit into the framework of God's Word and the prophecies of the end time. We've done that a little bit today. It's trendy now to learn about non-Christian religions because they've impacted our world in such a powerful way. And at the same time, traditional Christianity seems to be losing its hold on Westerners. Our world seems headed in diametrically opposite directions based on culture and, yes, even on religion. Looking ahead, there might well be a powerful Christian backlash to some of this. There's already a great growth in Christian denominations, and I use the word loosely, in Africa, South and Central America, but not so much North America and Europe, the cradle of Christianity. All of this may make our world begin to describe itself more in terms of North and South than East and West, and that would certainly be interesting in terms of prophecy, wouldn't it? That would fit with Daniel 11, and perhaps the stage could begin to be set for what? We'll need to watch. But what is our most important task? I haven't articulated it quite that directly yet today, but I hope you've already picked it up. Our most important task is knowing, obeying, and loving God's truth. And that's good, because that we can choose to act on, can't we? Unlike the events that erupted around the family of Abraham and Malkah Yura in 1938, that they could not control, this is something we can control. Brethren, I'd like to ask you to think about that as we keep looking forward always to the future that God says will happen.